Welcome to the Back Issue Banter Podcast. We're your hosts, Brad Page
and Chris Caron. Each episode, we'll look back at some of our favorite issues and storylines, along with the creators behind those books, celebrating what we love about comics.
So grab those trade paperbacks off the bookshelf, rummage through your long boxes, or fire up your digital reader and join us for some Back Issue Banter.
Welcome to Chris and Brad Talking Comics. I'm Chris Caron.
Well, I must be Brad then.
You must be. And of course, we both have our own individual podcasts. I do a music podcast called Mr. K's Super Show, in which we talk about different subjects each month. It's a lot of fun. And Brad, why don't you tell everybody about your podcast?
Sure. I do a show called I'm in Love with That Song, where we each episode we take a song and kind of do an in-depth analysis of it. But besides both of us being comics, being music fans, and we should also mention we did a Led Zeppelin podcast together.
The pod remains the same, which is still available. All the episodes are up. There are 16 in a total. If you're a Led Zeppelin fan, or if you're thinking about becoming a Led Zeppelin fan, give it a listen, because you know we talk a lot about Zeppelin. Brad has also appeared on many episodes of my show as a guest, and we've always had a good time. And I guess basically what this comes down to, Brad, is our origin story, because every super comic book has to have an origin story.
That's right. And besides both being big music fans, we're also comic book fans. And in fact, that's how we met. Why don't you tell the story?
Well, yeah, this was about 1988, I believe. And at the time I lived in Massachusetts. And basically back then, if there's a little hole in the wall music store or a comic book shop, I could find it. Well, one day I'm driving around Chelmsford, Mass., which is not far from where I lived at the time, Lowell, and I see this place called All Star Collectibles. Oh, all right. I haven't seen this place before. So I go in there and I pick out about $30 worth of vintage Mad magazines. And I go to the guy behind the counter, who just happens to be Brad.
Hey,
are you willing to, wheel and deal a little here? And he goes, and he knocks it down about 20. From that point onward, every week on my day off, because I had Thursdays off back then, I was working for Market Basket, and which is a New England supermarket chain, in case somebody's listening to this somewhere else. I would go in on my days off, and basically we would do what we've been doing on the podcast for like the last couple of years or so. Talk about music, comic books, whatever. If we had known back then, I would have brought a tape recorder with me every week, and we could have just had the first year of the show right there.
Right. We basically did a weekly podcast talking to each other, which I think is probably how a lot of podcasts start like that. But All Star Collectibles was this kind of weird odds and ends store where we sold baseball cards and we sold records.
Yes.
And we sold comics. And at the time I had come from working in a record store, but I kind of wanted to indulge my comic habit as well, and so that's how I ended up at All Star and worked there for a couple of years before I had kids and had to get a real job, and things moved on from there. But then, like 30 years later, you and I connected again.
Well, yeah, one day I walked in there to shoot the breeze with you, and I was informed that you had left you were no longer there, and I didn't have your number.
I left the building.
Brad had left the building, and I. Like 30 years later or so, I'm on Facebook or whatever, and I see your name on Pods and Sods as Brad Page. I think it sounds familiar. I wonder if that's Brad Page I remember. So I emailed you on Facebook because I seen your Facebook profile. I'm like, that could be him. I mean, it's 30 years, so you look a little
fatter and balder.
A little older, and like, yeah, that's me. And the next thing you know, we were on, I think I had you come on my show, and I think the first one we did was actually The Song Remains the Same. So even though we were doing my show, we had already kind of set the stage for what we would do for the 16 episodes of The Pod Remains, which just finished last month. And, I wanted to kind of keep it going because I think we have a good thing here. And with comics, there's certainly a lot to talk about.
There is. And just between the two of us, we talk a lot about music and we love music and it means a lot to us. But, so does comics. And this is kind of like a welcome change or addition or mixing it up to the stuff that we usually talk about. I know there are plenty of podcasts out there, but I think we've kind of got an interesting approach to what we're going to do on this show. So for those of you folks who are listening, I think primarily what we're going to do is just revisit some classic comic book superhero stories. As popular as superheroes are, really, they are most at home in comics, I think.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's ever been a movie or a TV show that has really exceeded or really touched what the best physical, good old newsprint paper comic book can do. That's where superheroes really shine. And so we're going to talk about some of our favorite stories. But to get things kicked off, there was recently a documentary on Stan Lee, and we thought, well, that would be a great place to kick things off, because really the modern comic book universe would not exist if it weren't for Stan Lee. So that's a great place to begin. So it's available on Disney Plus for anyone who subscribes to Disney Plus. It's about an hour and a half, and it's been somewhat controversial amongst comic fans, but I loved it. I just watched it again last night in prep to talk about it again. And I just, you know, really enjoyed it. As a comic fan, there's not maybe not a ton that's new, but there's a lot to recommend about it. So let's get into it, Chris. Let's talk a little bit about the show. What was your initial reaction?
Well, I like the fact that, you know, Stan was able to narrate his own life story, because obviously Stan was not shy about talking about himself and his life. And pointing out his many accomplishments. So, you know, they had all this great archival footage set, you know, to his voice, and he's telling the story. But of course, you know, as you know how comic book fanboys of any kind of artistic thing really are, this has stirred up a lot of controversy. People are saying Stan's still taking too much credit for things that he did or didn't do or whatever. I mean, I wouldn't put him on like par with, say, a Bob Kane. Maybe he's a bit of a glory hog. Maybe he's a bit of a self-promoter. Maybe he's a little full of himself, or was full of himself. But you know what? So what? I think by and large, what he did was significant, and nobody can take that away.
Absolutely. I think that one thing that every hardcore comics fan really needs to do is take a step back and just really look at the state of modern comics and the popularity of the characters today, and really understand that the comic book industry may not even have even exist today. It may not have survived if it wasn't for Stan. We can argue over how much he really created or contributed to the characters and the stories, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But more than anything, he was the spokesman, the cheerleader for an entire industry. There's nobody else out there who touches him for that. You know what I mean? There is no character equivalent of him that I can think of in any other field or industry. You know, there's a bunch of film directors: Scorsese, Spielberg, Christopher Nolan, who, you know, articulate how important the history of film is. There's not one person who is head and shoulders above in the public imagination for actors or films or politics or history, or, I mean, I don't care what industry you're talking about, the auto industry. You know, there's always people who are, you know, seen as spokesmen, but there's just nobody. Like, Stan was head and shoulders above, even before the reign of the superhero movies as being big budget, big things that everybody knows about. Even your grandmother knows, you know, there's been Avengers movies. Before any of that, if you had asked somebody 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, if to name someone in the comic industry, almost everybody would have said, you know, they've heard of Stan Lee.
Right. And you know? if you look, If you look back, like to the early 60s when Marvel really started to take root, they were coming out of the 50s and the whole oh God, what was that guy's name? The guy who
Frederick Wortham.
Frederick Wortham. You know, he wrote this book called Seduction of the Innocent that claimed that comic books were corrupting people. So as a result, corrupting youth rather,
Right.
contributing to the downfall of our society. They were trash books, trash literature, whatever you want to call it. So by that point, the comic book industry was just producing very neutered, flighty sci-fi entertainment that wasn't really having much of an impact. Save maybe DC, who was kind of in the process of reinventing their own universe. But Marvel filled a void for comic books where you had these more realistic characters. I mean, there's on the Big Bang Theory, I saw this episode recently. It has one of my favorite jokes where the guy says, "Hey, look, it's Amazing Spider-Man 183. It's the one where he loses a fight and breaks up with his girlfriend." Now, of course, the joke, of course, is that that's every issue of Amazing Spider-Man,
Right.
especially back then.
Yeah.
But the point is that, you know, any one of these heroes, and Spider-Man's a great point, he can save New York from, you know, Dr. Octopus, and, you know, we're all safe. He goes home, the rent is due. His girlfriend breaks up with him. His aunt has had his 87th heart attack. He doesn't get a break just because he's Spider-Man and just, you know, saved everybody. I mean, the Fantastic Four, I was in the documentary, there's one where they defaulted on their rent at the Baxter Building and got
Yeah.
evicted. I mean, you know, that kind of thing didn't happen back in
No.
the 50s or the 40s. You know, comics were just seen as light, fluffy. You know, okay, the hero goes through this, but that by the end of it, everything is back to where it was. Whereas a Marvel comic could end with the most world-shattering event that the hero could be facing, and none of them were spared. And you know, you had like not only Stan, obviously Stan was like the primary writer, but you had like Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, John Romita Sr., who recently passed away, and we will do a
Yeah,
tribute
we'll
to at some point. We
talk
will
about him
talk,
because he's
but we kind of
important.
figured for the first episode we wanted to tackle something a little more, you know, the Stan Lee documentary. It's causing a lot of controversy. You know, Stan's taking too much credit. Stan's a glory hawk, but like you said, Brad, there was nobody like Stan when he was alive. I mean, he was out there. Here's a guy who basically stopped writing comics, what, 50 years ago in the early 70s,
Really? Yeah.
supposedly.
I mean, by the mid-70s, he was not really writing anything of any substance,
But yet, he was still out there pressing the flesh and being like the
Right.
ambassador. I mean, he basically his job was basically like you said, a cheerleader. He was going out to comic book conventions. You know, he had other ventures that he did later in life, some of which were kind of controversial, and I'm not going to get into that here.
No.
He was still primarily known for being the guy who co-created Spider-Man, the Fantastic, basically the Marvel Universe as we know it, the core of that Marvel Universe.
Absolutely, but you know what? It's more than that because he was the champion for the entire form of
Oh, yeah.
comics, and that's what makes him special. It wasn't he was always, singing the praises of Marvel and being, Marvel's number one cheerleader, but above and beyond that, it was the form of comics itself that he was a tireless promoter of, even long after he stopped writing and frankly stopped reading.
Yeah,
I don't
right.
personally, I'm not sure how much of a real comics fan he was, but he was a figurehead of the entire industry, and I keep saying it and I'll say it again. There was nobody else like him in any other industry as someone who just he represented the entire industry for not just fans, but even casual people who had just a fleeting awareness of comics probably knew the name Stan Lee, probably had seen him on some, Tom Snyder show or somewhere along the lines they had seen Stan. And so, we could argue about, well, how much did he really contribute to creating character X or character Y? But the most important thing he did was I believe he saved the entire industry because the comics at multiple points were a dying industry. And I think his cheerleading of it, his just constantly bringing a face to a really faceless industry, because we don't see who these people are, right? You see the results of their work, but you don't see them, the artists and the writers. But he was the face of the industry, and he would, like you said, he would always go into conventions and speaking engagements, and just for years and years and years just promoted the Marvel characters, but above and beyond that, the whole form of comics. And so he meant a lot to me.
Oh yeah.
Sure, to you.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, like, is there a comparable person in DC who you would say defined DC comics?
No, absolutely not. Now, there were people as important to the publishing of DC,
yeah.
Julie Schwartz and Carmen Infantino, and it's a whole bunch of them. But the general public has no idea who these people were. You know, they weren't out there.
Yeah, we know that because we're comic book geeks.
Right.
And, you know, getting back to something you said about, you know, you doubt that he read the comics. Well, in 1989, I went to a convention, and Stan, I got to meet him. You know, I didn't think to take a camera with me, or because I didn't have a cell phone, obviously, back then, 89, 90, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And somebody at one point asked him, somebody who, you know, asked him about one of the current comic books at the time. And he's like, and he turns to the guy, he goes, "What's the guy who writes that?" He goes, "Look, they send me a stack of books every month. I don't really have time to read them. You know, I don't really keep up with these things. So I don't know who's doing, you know, who's on what." But right. Yeah, I mean, we, like I said, we know Julia Schwartz, we know Carmine Infantino, Jeanette Kahn. We know that because we're comic book geeks.
Right.
The average person on the street has no clue who Julia Schwartz was, or, you know, you might know Frank Miller, but that's because of Dark Knight Returns and not necessarily because he's a DC guy. But
right.
Stan, you know, Stan kind of put himself front and center, you know, face front true believers. And, you know, he kind of imbued upon Marvel, like, the whole face front true believer. I mean, one of the things I thought was very amusing, and I've heard it before, was the Marty Marvel Marching Society song.
Yes.
And
which
they
is featured,
like,
in the documentary.
Yeah. This, and they have like a little excerpt where Jack Kirby's bantering with him, and then even Flo Steinberg, fabulous Flo.
Yeah.
And she's like, "Oh, hello, everybody," you know, and Steve Ditko just jumped out a window. I think he really is Spider-Man. And they tried to foster this sense that there was a Marvel bullpen,
yep.
like in baseball, and, you know, Jolly Jack Kirby and, you know, Rascally Roy Thomas and, you know, Jaunty John Romita or whatever, you know. And, you know, let's face it, as we know, Marvel was like any workplace. It had its highs and lows. People sometimes
sure.
got along, sometimes didn't. You know, sometimes people claimed that they did more work than others. Again, you know, if it wasn't for Stan, you know, you look back on it, like, the story, this common story is that Stan was at the end of his rope and decided he didn't want to write comic books anymore. So his wife said, "Why don't you just write the kind of comics you want to read?"
Right.
And he did, and that started with Fantastic Four. And then, like, this, I love the story about Spider-Man, how he pitches it to Martin Goodman, who was his the publisher. Mm-hmm. And Martin Goodman says, "Nobody wants to see a Spider-Man." So he puts right. Spider-Man in the last issue of a title that's being canceled, Amazing Fantasy number 15. Mm-hmm. And then, like, it sells. So Martin Goodman says, "Stan, you know that idea you had about the Spider-Man? That's a really good idea. We should publish that." And look at it now. Spider-Man is probably Marvel's biggest character.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and that Mary Marvel Marching Society record, if you try to buy that today, it's going to cost you about $800-900 to
yeah.
find it. It's pretty rare. And but that just shows, you know, how hardcore fans are. But yeah, it the documentary, getting back to that, I agree. One of the things I really loved about it is it's almost entirely in Stan's voice. You don't need, the omniscient announcer or voiceover. You've got plenty of sources of Stan talking about Stan
oh, yeah.
and about Marvel right. history. They also, I think, pretty generously include quotes voiceover from Jack.
Yep.
Jack Kirby. Of course, there is none that exists from Steve Ditko. So it's not that they didn't.
Yeah, he really
use it.
Was.
Just, he avoided all publicity. And he, that's, as far as I know, there's maybe two photographs of him
yeah.
that exist.
Very mysterious guy, very kind of odd duck, but
Yeah, he was not a recluse. I mean, he worked in an office in New York. You know, he didn't like hide out in his basement.
No, but he wasn't.
But he was not. Like, he didn't agree in publicity. He was the opposite of Stan in that he didn't.
Oh my God.
He was not interested in publicizing himself. He was
if they ever do a Steve Ditko documentary, they'll be hard pressed to probably even find any audio of him where he's talking about himself because, you know, like you said, he was not a publicity guy. I mean, you know, right. Jack and, you know, Jack Kirby and Stan Lee were, you know, didn't have a problem promoting themselves.
Right. Right. You know, and both of them, Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby are absolutely creative masters. I think Jack is a significant figure in pop culture. He is every bit as important in his way as Stan. Mm-hmm. I love Jack. I'm a huge just admirer of just endless creativity on this guy, endless imagination. But he could never have done what Stan did. He was not going to be the kind of guy who could he was a creative genius, but he was not like great at articulating to the masses his, you know, his just the whole thing that Stan was great at, that great communicator, right? Stan was a great communicator, and Jack was not in terms of like public speaking. I mean, he was, you know, I love all the interview footage and stuff that's out there and getting to hear his voice and stuff, but it's not like Stan. He could not have done what Stan did, which was essentially Stan, you know, saved Marvel from completely going out of business probably more than once. And as a result, really saved the entire comic book industry.
Well, you saw what happened later on when Jack was given full reign over his own work, whereas he was writing it, editing it, drawing it. And, you know, the dialogue and sometimes some of the ideas don't come across as effectively as they could. Right. He's got great ideas. He's a master in terms of plotting and pacing because, you know, as we know, because of that Marvel method, Stan would give him the barest bones of a plot. Sometimes, you know, just this is the story that I heard. You can correct me if I'm wrong. It could be an urban legend that when it came to the Galactus trilogy from Fantastic Four 48 through 50, supposedly all he said to Jack Kirby was, have them fight God. Whether that's true or not, but like I said, you know, and Stan pointed this out, because of necessity to keep the artists working, artists like Ditko and Jack Kirby would just be given, okay, have them do this, this, and this. And then it would be the responsibility of them to kind of pace it, you know, put it in panelized form. And, you know, and it's not an easy thing. I read somewhere that once Gil Kane would tend to kind of slowly put, you know, pace a story. And then all of a sudden the last two pages, he'd have to kind of condense a lot of events just mm-hmm. to kind of get to the end of the story. But, you know, it was a different method, but it's a method that a lot of artists and writers, both at Marvel and DC, would do for many decades. I don't think they do that now anymore. I think it's more controlled.
I'm not really sure. I do believe that, you know, the Marvel method was essential to creating the books that we got and would not have been the same if it had been done any other way. But I also think that introduced this whole thing of, you know, who created what and yeah. the endless arguments because it was so loosey-goosey, you know. There is a script that exists for, or a very detailed outline or whatever, however you want to look at it, for the first issue of Fantastic Four yeah. that Stan wrote. And so, you know, but there's also, you look at the Fantastic Four and then you look at something like the Challengers of the Unknown, which is a group of four characters that Jack had done previously for DC. And there's certain a lot of similarities there, but Stan also, there's also this script, and I, you know, some, there's even been some people who say, oh well, he wrote that script after the fact. I highly doubt that.
Yeah, why would you do that? When would you have time?
Right I don't think, you know, even the worst thing you can say about Stan, I don't think he's sleazy enough
No.
To have done something like that just to prove his authorship. I think that's legit. And everything in that script did not make it into the Fantastic
Right.
Four. Now, as time went on and more, they published more and more titles. I think you got more and more into the realm of it went from Stan writing some kind of script and handing that over to an artist to the point where it was just, you know, have the Fantastic Four fight Dr. Doom on the moon on the next issue. Go at it. And that was the extent to which Stan was involved in the plot. But it would come back and he would write the dialogue. And that's pretty much undisputed. And so much of that characterization of each of those characters comes from that dialogue. So, you know, Stan always had some degree of input in it. I just think sometimes the pendulum swings the other way and people just don't want to give Stan credit for anything. And I don't think that's fair either, but it's absolutely true that Ditko and especially Kirby, never got the credit that they deserved. Lot of that on Stan. I don't think you pin all of it on Stan, but, you know, I do appreciate the fact that in this documentary that they do. You know, it's a love letter to Stan. They're not going to highlight and go deep into all this, but they do include some stuff that, you know, both the voiceovers that they put in there from Jack, that pretty infamous radio show where Stan was on a New York radio station and Jack called in, Jack was on the radio,
right,
being interviewed. And Stan calls in to wish him a happy birthday. And it very quickly, the conversation goes downhill and they start arguing over who created what, you know, and at the end of it, when Stan hangs up, Jack says essentially, well, now you know what I had to deal with for all those years. And, you know, it's an uncomfortable thing, but it happened. And I think it's very fair that they included that in the documentary. It's not just, you know, all sunshine and rainbows about Stan. I also love the fact that, you know, the very first clip you see of Stan, it's the original Stan, right? Where he's balding, he's wearing a buttoned up shirt and tie. He's got no mustache, no goatee, no beard. And then very quickly you see shots of him like 10 years later and he's got a full head of hair.
Yeah, right.
He's got a big beard. What happened? You know, I mean, there's, you know, it's very clear, like they never discuss it, but there was a physical transformation of Stan Lee, as he became more popular. You know, it's all vanity, right? He got the hair piece.
Well, you know, it's funny that clip you mentioned, the opening clip, I think he looks older in that clip. Mm-hmm. He looks like a middle-aged man. I mean, he probably was at that point.
He was a middle-aged man.
But he looks like one. He does not look like the hip Stan the man.
Right. And like 5 years later, not even 10 years, 5 years later, you know, there's clips of him speaking at colleges. And once he got on that college circuit, that's my personal opinion. You know, once he started really getting attention from particularly college kids, I think like that was really when, you know, all the hair piece came and the goatee, the beard, all, you know, the big sideburns, all of that.
He became kind of like a hipster in a way, like this cool,
right?
You know, like, you know, the godfather of Marvel, as they used to call him, I think, back then. And yeah, mm-hmm. he like, it's funny, like, I don't think he started out, obviously he started out as Stanley Lieber. But I think he, over time, became Stan Lee. Like, Stan Lee is as much a creation of Stan Lee as any of the heroes he co-created.
Right. Oh, it's been said many times that Stan Lee's greatest creation was Stan Lee.
He reinvented himself in a way that most people don't or can't.
In the documentary, there's a clip where he says, I think very tellingly, that, you know, when he talks about when he created Stan Lee, because he didn't want to use his full name, right? Stanley Lieber, but he refers to it as like, as that became his alter ego. He uses the word alter ego, and I think that's very significant because it's true, right? I think Stan Lee became a character. that he played.
Oh, he definitely
and
did.
eventually, you know, like anyone who plays the same character 24/7, well, where then that then it when does the real Stan and the fake, you know, the alter ego Stan, they become one and the same by the end.
It's kind of like Alice Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rock musician, we both know that he started out as Vincent Furnier and the band was originally called Alice Cooper. Well, eventually people started referring to him as Alice because he was the singer in the band. You know, they asked me why the singer's name was Alice. Well, he got to the point where Alice became such a big part of him and who he was that he, like Stan Lee, became a character. And he ended up changing. I think he Vincent Furnier legally changed his name to Alice Cooper and trademarked it.
Right. And then he started living that life of that character on and off stage, which led to a lot of, you know, drug issues and whatnot, mental issues for Alice. You know, Stan didn't have that. But I think it's true that that he eventually became the character that he sort of played in his public appearances. And then he became that guy 24/7.
And you wonder, like, at one point, was Stanley Lieber still there at all? Was he ever around, like maybe in private when it was just him and his wife and his kid? But that's what made him Stan Lee, was the fact that he was bigger than life. You know, he was kind of like that guy, you know, who, like I said, you'd probably almost expect him to be a car salesman if he hadn't gone into comic books.
Right.
He would have been selling something because he had that huckster thing.
Oh, absolutely.
And let's, you know, but on the other hand, you know, he kind of imbued that to Marvel, like, you know, they had the Marvel bullpen bulletins and they did Stan Soapbox. They said, hey, we're coming out this month with the new Silver Surfer comic and you kids are going to want to read it because it's just great. Jazzy John Buscema is drawing it and blah, blah, blah. You know, he really made it feel like Marvel was, it's like a universe unto itself with the creators and the writers. And I mean, even to the point where, like, you knew who Flo Steinberg is. Flo Steinberg was basically like a secretary or a receptionist.
Girl Friday, as the term. That's a term you don't hear anymore, but that was her title, Girl Friday.
One of the, like, Back Issue Magazine did like a fanzine where they just wrote about her. Like, they even had like a mock cover. I think it was Marie Severin drew it. Fabulous Flo. And it was done like in the Fantastic Four logo style. And it was just like, it looked like Flo Steinberg had entered into an old Marvel comic, but she's like got things tucked under her arm. She's got, like, you know, a pen, you know, she's like, she's obviously clearly overworked. But yet, like, even though she left, like, in the early 70s, people were still going on about Fabulous Flo. Like, you know, Gene Simmons, I think, referenced her in one thing. Gene Simmons knew who she was.
And, yeah. And, you know, the about the only other person I can maybe think of who is somewhat equivalent to Stan in their industry would be somebody like a Steve Jobs.
Right. And he's not in comics, obviously, you know, like,
no, but in just in terms of like way that Steve Jobs, the role he played in as sort of this technology, you know, spokesman for a technology generation or whatever.
Yeah.
But tell me, who was Steve Jobs' secretary?
No.
And I bet even most Apple fans don't know. But every Marvel, hardcore Marvel fan knows who Flo Steinberg is.
Aside from Steve Wozniak, who was like his chief programmer? Who was his chief, you know, coder? Beats the hell out of me.
Right. But because Stan created that whole, like you said, this family, bullpen family, that we all knew their names growing up, you know, you knew who the letterer was, you know, Artie Simek and, you know, and that's all due to Stan.
I can tell by looking at an old Marvel comic who the letterer was, because they all had such distinctive styles.
Right. Sam Rosen.
Sam Rosen, Artie Simek, you know. I mean, you felt kind of like you knew the people at Marvel. You didn't really know them, obviously. You never
met them. Of course not.
But they felt like you could almost feel, you felt like if you saw them on the street, you could just walk up to them and say, hey, Jack, how's it going? Hey, John. Hey, Stan. Hey, Flo. You know.
Right.
Kind of thing.
Right. You're on your first name basis with these creators of things that were creating that were such a big part of your life when you were a kid, a comic book fan. You know, let's face it, a lot of young comic book fans were maybe a little bit of the odd ducks, right?
No, not them. Not us.
You know, maybe a bit of a loner, you know? So, you know, these people became kind of like, I don't know if family is the right word, but they were friends in a way. They were like aunts and uncles, maybe, or
Right.
they were just, you know, people that you sort of, you know, you looked up to, but you also felt kind of connected with because of that whole environment that Stan fostered. As bogus as it may have been, you know, by the time you and I were reading comics in the 70s and 80s, there was really no bullpen. People were all working
No,
from
that was
home
that
and
era
all.
was over.
But that feeling stayed, and they perpetuated that myth, and it was a harmless myth, you know, but it was, you know, and you just, you know, you didn't have that in DC,
No, I
certainly
just said,
not
yeah,
in the
you just
earlier
said.
days, you know, like, but you didn't have a connection to Carmen Infantino or you know, Julie Schwartz or any of those guys.
No,
There's a bit in the Stan Lee documentary where he's, and I would love to find it and watch the whole episode, where he's on Tom Snyder
yes.
and Julie Schwartz is there. It's like a little round table or panel
Yeah.
discussion. And Julie Schwartz is there, and there's some kid who I don't know who he was, Warren Storab,
Yeah,
something like
I
that.
never heard of him.
Very articulate kid, though, and he's there to represent your average, your big comic book fan. And it's just this great discussion that they're having. And you know, we were talking before about this is the height of Stan and his beard and his hairpiece and
This
trying
is
to
Stan Lee in
looking like one
full
of the kids. Julie Schwartz is there looking like your high school principal and
effect.
basically arguing that like kids don't want relevance in comics, you know, they
And the
want to be
kid did.
entertained.
And one of the
And the
kids are there telling him, yeah, we do. He's even
right.
telling him that he wouldn't recommend a Superman comic to anybody over the age of
Exactly. He
12.
says, I
What is.
wouldn't recommend Batman and Superman to anyone who wasn't, you know, over 10 years old,
Right.
but I would recommend these Marvel books. I'm paraphrasing,
There was
but you know,
somebody
that's what
else in
he's
that
saying.
interview as well, but I couldn't tell
I
who it was.
don't, I'm not sure who else, you know, I don't remember who the other person was, but it looks like a fascinating discussion. I'd love to find that if it's on, probably on YouTube somewhere and
Yeah,
just
I'd
watch
like
the
to
whole
find too.
thing because it's
Yeah.
very cool. But you know, the and you know, you look at those people sitting on that round table and it Stan, you know, is he's by far, you know, more even physically more connected to the kid than anyone else there. You know, just he looks like, you know, a hipster.
Yeah. And he, you know, even though at that point he was no longer writing the comic books, by that point
No.
he had moved up, you know, and that was a point where obviously Roy Thomas was the editor in chief.
And
And you're
Roy
getting,
is not much, Roy, but he Roy is in the
yeah,
documentary for a
but
bit.
you're getting more like a diver more diversity, and diversity in the sense that it's not just Stan writing it anymore. It's
Right.
you've got Steve Englehart, you got Roy Thomas, you got Jerry Conway, Marv Wolfman, Len Wein.
Yep, Steve
Steve Gerber,
Gerber,
all these
yep,
different
Jim
guys
Starlin.
who are bringing Jim Starlin, who are bringing in their own idiosyncrasies, their own approaches to these established characters, and I think that's probably when you and I kind of jumped into the fray.
Yes.
Because my first issue of Spider-Man was Amazing Spider-Man 140, which was Jerry Conway and Ross Andrew, Ross Andrew being the artist, and Jerry Conway the writer, and you know, it wasn't until I started collecting because they had Marvel Tales, which was a reprint title. Which is a great way. I mean, I knew they were old stories, but it was a great way to sort of read some of the older stuff from the 60s that I didn't, you know, I didn't know about back issues back then. And, you know, when you're a little kid, you don't have a lot of money.
At least around where you and I lived,
No.
I knew of one store in Lowell, actually,
Yeah.
that sold old back issues. And
Yeah.
going there was like a pilgrimage, and we had to, like, you know, con our one of our parents into
Well,
dropping a few of us off there for a couple of hours. But it was rare, you know. You and I, we bought our books off a spinner rack
yeah.
at the local drugstore or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I remember one of them was a store at the Salem, New Hampshire, at the Rockingham Mall called Smoker's Corner. My dad would go in there to buy cigarettes. But of course, they probably figured, well, people are bringing their kids in here, so I'd always end up, you know, hassling my dad for a comic book, and I usually left with one. But I remember not even seeing my first vintage comic book until 78. The Methuen Mall had like a comic, I guess you could say it was like a Comic Con in the center of the mall, but they had, and I found for like 250 an old Spider-Man from like 1968. My dad, I don't know why, he made me put it back. made me get my money back. And I think to myself, I spent 250 on a book that who knows would be worth today. And then, you know, a couple of years later, I used to go to this place in Methuen called Paperback Book Swap. My mom used to go there. And it was like you said, you'd bring in your old paperbacks, they'd give you store credit, and you'd leave with a, you know, a bag full of. There was this kid there, his this kid who named Chris, and he, and you know what I'm talking about. And he, all of a sudden, there's a book of, there's like a box of comics in the back, one box, but within a year, that whole back room was occupied with comics, and he was selling subscriptions. A few years later, you know, the store moved to Salem, and then he took over the business because there was, I remember at one point when it was still called the Book Swap or whatever, they were selling cigarettes. Well, you know, you're running a comic book store, you probably shouldn't be selling cigarettes to kids. So eventually, he just took over the store, lock, stock, and barrel, and it's still in, you know, in business today, Christmas Comics. But what I'm saying is, I, you know, like you, I didn't even know about that place in Lowell. If I'd known, I might have got my dad to take me there. But you know, I do remember reading about back issues, but having access or seeing them until I saw that thing at the Methuen Mall. But yeah, so you know, the reprint titles were great for people like us who didn't, you know, who could, you know,
Right.
just spend 25 cents, 30 cents, whatever it was, because you remember when comic books were that cheap.
Yeah. Oh, or you'd get like an annual, and maybe half of it would be new material, and the back half of the book would be reprints of
Yeah,
classic
Marvel was
stories, you know,
notorious for
things like
not,
that.
they were not shy about recycling
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Their back catalog, you know, especially like with the Treasury editions. But yeah,
Yeah, the
those,
Treasury. Do you had books like you mentioned Marvel Tales? There was a book called Marvel Triple Action, I think.
yep,
There was reprinting Avengers. There
yeah.
was yeah, there was all kinds of ways that they would recycle. And a lot of that, I think, was just flooding the newsstand to try to keep DC or other competitors off the newsstand.
Well, yeah, Marvel was, you know, like we said, Marvel, and this is, you know, this is probably more a reflection of like Roy Thomas and the Marv Wolfmans and Len Wein's, where they were experimenting into like black and white magazine publishing, which, you know, they were doing pretty good there for a while with Planet of the Apes and other things. But, you know, getting back to Stan, you know, here it is the 70s, and now you've got Stan not only like publisher, but he's transitioning to being like this sort of, like you said, this cheerleader or a spokesperson. And at some point, he ends up de dealing with Hollywood. And of course, in 1977, 78, we get the Incredible Hulk TV movie, which became a TV show not long after. Say of that what you will. I think it was a good show for its time for what it was. I, you know, was it a
I
faithful
mean,
adaptation?
was it great? No,
No.
but I mean, you know, you had Wonder Woman with Linda Carter. Was that a great show? No, but you know, that's all we had.
Exactly. I
And, you
mean,
know,
yeah, and
and I
they.
mean, Linda Carter was great.
Oh
I mean, the
yeah.
show was not well written,
You
but
can't, yeah, but then again, Linda Carter in that outfit, you know, part of you know, you're a young kid and you're just kind of looking at her going, I don't give a damn if the show's any good or not. It's like
mean,
Charlie's Angels. You watch Charlie's Angels now, you realize you weren't
sure.
watching it for the great acting.
Yeah, no, I mean, but you could say that about every 70s, it's 60s and 70s TV shows, and even into the 80s, a lot of them were not, where they were pretty poorly written. But, you know, we as it's just, and now this is where we start to sound like really old men,
Yes.
but, you know, kids today
Kids today,
don't understand
goddamn kids.
the just a paucity of information that was of comic book material that was available to you, because now, you know, there's so many movies. I mean, they made a TV show about Moon Knight. Had you asked either of us 20, 30 years
Oh
ago,
my God,
it would,
no.
you know, we wouldn't have believed you if you said there was going to be a legit Batman movie, let alone a TV show about Moon Knight. I mean, it's, you know, we it's an embarrassment of riches that we have now. But when you and I were growing up, I mean, you had Super Friends, which was a super cheesy
Well,
cartoon,
you realize that
right?
now, but back then we thought it was the ba greatest thing.
Because that was all you had, you know. You had
Shazam!
Wonder
Remember the
Woman, you had the Incredible
Saturday?
Hulk show.
Remember Shazam?
Sure,
But you
yeah, and
realize, and you watch it
ISIS.
now, you realize like he never actually ever fought a supervillain at all on that show. It was always a moral, like kids don't do
Yeah.
drugs, kids don't run away from home, kids talk to your parents. You know, all these kids always had problems, and you know, don't talk to strangers. But if two strange men in a Winnebago approach you, it's okay. You know, you can go in there
Right,
anyway.
in a skin-tight outfit.
Right.
They're okay.
But you know, and then like in 1977, we get the Amazing Spider-Man TV movie with Nicholas Hammond, which became a kind of, it became a show, but not a regular show. It seemed to be on and off, off and on. Like it seemed to be they just would use it to fill in the spots in the schedule. you watch that now, and it's not very good. It's just a standard issue 70s action show. Again, no supervillains really. You know, he looked, but you took what you could get back then.
Right. There was hardly any, and toys, like there weren't very many superhero toys that you could buy, few and far between. And when they were, it would be like, I don't know, a Spider-Man gun or something. Like Spider-Man never used a gun. Like,
right.
You know what I mean? Like they'd just take a Spider-Man logo or something and slap it on, but forget it. There were no Iron Man toys. There were no Captain America toys. It was Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, some Hulk stuff when the TV show, but that was it. You just had, so there was the saturation.
Yes.
That's what I'm looking for. The saturation of superhero toys and movies and TV shows that everyone complains about now. But for those of us growing up, we didn't have any of that. We would have died for a tenth of it.
Well, I remember, you know, obviously we finally kind of got our dream come true in 1978 with Superman, the first Superman movie with Christopher Reeve. Right. And that inspired some merchant. But, and now you think that would have inspired a rash of comic book movies. It didn't.
Nope.
And so all we had, you know, were the comic books. So every month, you know, we'd go to our spinner racks or we'd go to a newsstand, wherever, and we'd pick out the latest Marvel and or DC comics. You know, I like both. I was certainly.
Yeah, me too.
But, you know, Marvel's always had the more, I think always Marvel always had the little more dramatic, like, covers.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. I was never like, you know, what would become what they called a Marvel zombie, right? That only read Marvel. Read DC, but my preference was mostly Marvel, I think, pretty easily. But yeah, sure, I would read Batman and the Spectre and Justice League. There was a lot of DC books I read, but yeah, you know, we had the spinner rack and that was about it.
And you know, you look around that time, they came out with which a lot of people say is the first graphic novel, which was The Silver Surfer by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, because it was a book. It was basically published as a book. It wasn't even published as like a Marvel treasury or a comic book. It came out as a, like, the term didn't exist back then, but you'd basically would call it a graphic novel today.
Today.
So yeah. Stan was still had his hand in it a little bit, but, like, you know, by this point, Stan, I think, I don't know if he'd moved out to LA or not, but I think by the early 80s, he moved out, and that's when officially he became like their, kind of like their ambassador, kind of like the guy who's like, oh, we're talking to, you know, this studio and that studio. And
yeah. And so much of it was, I'm not going to say it was bullshit. A certain percentage of it was, a lot of it was wishful thinking. A lot of it was Stan just trying to get stuff. I mean, think about this, that your job essentially is to take these characters from the company, and he was still essentially an employee for the company. He made more money than Jack or Ditko or anything, but Stan did not own those characters either.
No.
And I think that's something that people forget.
Right.
That, you know, a lot of that, you know, Jack created all these characters and never got, well, you know what? Stan didn't get, he didn't own them either, you know, and sure, he got a much bigger paycheck from Marvel than anybody else, but he was still a company man. Those characters were not owned by him. But so his job is to flog these characters to Hollywood, and he's out there for 20, maybe 30 years with virtually zero success. You know, when any of these things got made, they were not great.
Yeah,
terrible.
We still have to deal with nightmares of the first Captain America movie from the early 90s. And
yeah, stuff that we shouldn't even, I don't even want to speak of. But, you know, and you know, so Stan was still writing his Stanley soapbox column. But by this time, most of it was just him, you know, we had this great meeting with some Hollywood director about making a Captain America movie, and then nothing would happen. And then, you know, the next month there would be talk about Silver Surfer movie, and, you know, none of these things ever came out.
Silver Surfer will be coming on to, brace yourselves, folks. The Silver Surfer will be hitting
right next year. And then, you know, nothing.
And, like I said, I would have thought Superman, especially the first two, would have inspired a rash. Like, we would have had, you know, DC movies and Marvel movies, but it didn't happen. I mean, basically, Superman and Supergirl, which was, as we know, was a flop, were basically it until Batman finally came out in 89, which was, of course, huge. But and then, then we got some comic book movies of varying success and varying,
Quality.
artistic quality.
Yeah.
But it really wasn't until the late 2000s, really, that we got the very first spate of Marvel movies with Iron Man and Incredible Hulk, and that
Right.
kind of paved the way. But there was no guarantee. But I mean, would we have had those movies were it not for Stan Lee? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. And and by that time, it was people roughly from our generation, a little older, a little younger, but just in that stretch, who had grown up with these comics and grown up with Stan and the voice of Stan on the cartoons and things like
Yeah, that's
that,
right. We've got,
that now those people suddenly were in some place of power, as directors, as filmmakers, as screenwriters, as studio executives and whatnot. And they were more open to the idea of doing comic book characters the way they were in the comics, or at least as close as they could get. Certainly way closer than they were ever done before. Usually, when we would see it, cut like that dreadful Captain America movie, these characters, by the time they made it to the screen, they barely represented what the character was in the comics. You
Yeah, it
know,
was just the name.
that right. It was just right. And usually their alter ego name, their street name was not the same. The costume would be different. The origin would be different. Everything about the character would be essentially
Yeah, why did
different.
you even bother to, like the
Right.
Punisher, why did you even bother to spend the money on it if you're not going to use the costume, the logo, the skull and crossbones thing? I mean,
Right.
I mean, like, look at like the Incredible Hulk, Dr. David Banner. Because
Right.
Bruce was considered to be not a very masculine name, and Mad Magazine like did this thing where they mentioned that, and then in the background you hear Bruce Jenner just won the decathlon, and Bruce Springsteen is the great,
Right.
so they're putting out the apocryphal. But yeah, Stan, it took a while. It really took, like you said, these executives, these people who grew up like us, like we might have been if we'd gotten jobs at movie studios, to champion these. And then because if you think about it, like for years, I don't know if they still do it, they probably don't anymore, but Marvel Comics for years, even after Stan stopped being the writer and the editor, would say presented Stan Lee presents. It
Right.
was always like the first page, the
Yep.
logo was always preceded by Stan Lee presents, which was a great way of kind of creating that illusion that Stan is still the the
Yep.
in the show, but he's really not.
Right.
We'll know,
Right.
there were multiple editors in chief over
He
the
was,
decades.
yeah, I mean, just a figurehead by,
Right.
for the last few decades of it. But, that counted for something. It mattered. And sure, as we get older and we learn more about the reality of it, does that take some of the shine off it? Sure. But I can't get angry about it.
No.
Going back to the documentary, like you said, there's been some controversy, some people dredging up, again, that while they don't give Jack enough credit, they don't give Ditko enough credit, they don't give a lot of these other creators any credit. But, I can't get too mad about it. I feel like they didn't completely whitewash everything.
No.
And how about somebody make a great documentary about Jack Kirby?
I
Because
would
his
love it.
story is
Because
fascinating.
the only thing you can find right now is you can go on YouTube and see some fan-made videos, some of which are okay. But I would love to see like a full-on, really well-done documentary
Yeah.
where, I'm sure like get some archival footage of Jack, talk to people in the industry. You can use some archival footage of Stan. Obviously, like you said, they made a good point in that documentary about that radio broadcast where they're kind of like, kind of getting on each other's case. But
Yep.
yeah, or do one on Ditko. I mean, Ditko, especially because he's more of an enigma.
Yep.
What do we know about Steve Ditko? Not a lot. He was a very quiet guy and kind of kept to himself. Jack was a little more out there and a little more.
Yeah, it would be easier to do a documentary on Jack because there's just more content. There's a British, don't really know what you call him, an actor or a writer, a Jonathan Ross. Do you know this guy, Jonathan Ross?
No, not really.
He hosted a series called The Incredibly Strange Film, something that's really great, really great. But I don't think this was a part of that, may have been, but he did something called a show called In Search of Steve Ditko. It's about the closest thing you're going to find that I know of as a fairly in-depth, you know, documentary on Ditko. And he interviews Stan for that. He and Neil Gaiman actually go to Ditko's office and try to get him on camera, and he won't do it. I think he says, you know, come up and I'll talk to you, but he won't allow the camera crew up. So they never actually get Ditko on camera. But it's very interesting. I would advise people to seek that out. There was also a video, I think it was a direct-to-video thing done called Masters of Comic Book Art in the 80s or early 90s, hosted by the writer, science fiction writer Harlan Ellison, where he interviewed key comic book writer artists. So they had to be both a writer and an artist to get in this. So Harvey Kurtzman, Jack is in there, Ditko is in there, but he doesn't appear. He wrote like a long screed that I think, I can't remember if he reads it or if Harlan Ellison reads it. Frank Miller's in there. So they went up to who was modern at the time. Bernie Wrightson is in there. That's worth seeking out. It was, to my knowledge, it was only out on VHS, but I'm sure it's out there somewhere on YouTube. Worth watching.
Say that again.
Masters of Comic Book Art.
I'll have to check that out. Yeah, I'll bet a few.
It's really good. It's really good. I like it a lot.
You know, like with Stan, I mean, one of the things they did starting with, you know, the Marvel movies was up till obviously his passing, Stan would always have a cameo in every movie. Like one little scene. Sometimes he had dialogue. Sometimes he didn't. You know, there was one where it was an Iron Man movie where he goes, "Oh, hey, Hef, how's it going?" And you see Stan with the pipe in his, and he's supposed to be like Hugh Hefner, I guess. Sometimes he played, like he drove a bus. Sometimes he would, but he always had like he'd have a little line sometimes, like, you know, "Will you stop that racket?" You know, and it was a trademark. I mean, you know, I used to go with the next girlfriend of mine and her son to go see these movies. Now, my ex-girlfriend was not a comic book fan by any stretch of the imagination. Even she knew who Stan Lee was.
Right. That's what I'm saying. You know,
yeah, people knew him. You know, because she, you know, she'd say, "Oh, there he is," you know, when he'd appear in the movie. Mm-hmm. And that's how popular he became. And that's how the general public, you know, like I said, DC. Who's DC's equivalent? Nobody. No. Julie Schwartz? You know, I don't know. Nobody.
I mean, there's been, you know, Paul Levitz, Jeanette Kahn, who you mentioned. There's been a lot of great people.
Yeah.
Great people in the, very creative, very smart people in the industry. We're not, you know, we're not knocking them to.
No.
It's just Stan was able to get himself on a whole other level. And you could call it being the ultimate huckster if you want. But the fact is, you know, he did it. And through that, he brought a lot of us into comics. He kept a lot of us as readers, as fans, in, you know, any industry would be lucky to have a guy like that.
You look at Disney, right? Now, Disney buys Marvel in, I don't know, the late 2000s or whatever.
Yeah. Walt Disney is another guy. Sorry to interrupt you, Chris, but he's another guy who's on that Stan level. But again, Walt didn't represent a whole industry. He just represented the face of Disney. But those people are few and far between.
Right. But when Disney bought Marvel, they also bought Stan Lee. They bought the mythology of Stan Lee, and they, you know, were not shy about utilizing him as a, you know, a spokesperson. You know, if anything, you've just bought this multi-billion-dollar investment that you want to milk, you know, for intellectual property.
Yep.
Okay, that's fine. You know, that makes sense. Here you've got a guy who basically created this universe, and he's now at your beck and call. And, you know, they put him in the movies. I think he, I'm sure he went to the movie premieres and probably talked them all up. Oh, this is going to be great. You know, this is,
Sure.
and you know, they knew, you know, Disney, you know, you can say what you want about them, good or bad, but if you or I spent $4 billion or $10 billion, whatever, and bought Marvel, we'd sure as hell want to exploit it. We'd sure as hell want to make movies and comic books and toys and games. And, but we wouldn't have Marvel because, you know, Marvel before it was called Marvel wasn't, I think it was called Timely or whatever.
Yeah, well, originally Timely, and then it was
Atlas.
Atlas Comics.
But neither
And
had an impact.
yeah, and I was just doing a little bit of research on this before we got on because I was curious. I couldn't remember the Marvel. So if you go back to the first issue of Fantastic Four, which is essentially the launch of the Marvel Universe, there's a little rectangle box on it that says MC on the cover. And that was the closest thing, but the word Marvel is nowhere on the cover. It was, I don't know. I couldn't, in the quick research I did, I couldn't find what was the first comic to feature the actual Marvel logo. But the first issue of Fantastic Four to have the Marvel logo on it was number 14. So that's interesting to me that Marvel, as the name, like wasn't on the cover of the books for the first over year, right? 13 issues of Fantastic Four. Just interesting bit of trivia, but you know, so yeah, Marvel didn't exist. You know, it was just Stan cre so all of this stuff was really kind of created on the fly, you know.
Well, look at the, you know, look at Fantastic Four. Martin Goodman, the publisher, says, "Hey, you know, DC's publishing a book about a team of superheroes called Justice League of America. Let's publish a team book." So he creates the Fantastic Four. And, you know,
With
obviously
Jack.
with
With
Jack,
Jack.
right? I'm sorry. Yeah, here I go. And I'm trying to do what Stan did. And it becomes, you know, a hit. And that's probably, and they're probably the only Marvel characters who have not had yet had a definitive cinematic treatment. There's been at
Right.
least two or three of them, one of which was never actually released, but we've, you know, we, you know what I'm talking about, the
Yeah, the Roger Corman thing,
which was
right?
actually produced only to retain
The
the
rights.
rights. But
Yeah.
people at the time thought, oh my God, I can't believe they're releasing this. That well, they never intended to, and they never did.
No.
It's become a very bootleg. But yeah, I mean, Stan Lee, the man, okay, is he a huckster? Like I said, is he a huckster? Yeah. Is he a bit of a car salesman? So what? Without him, we don't have the Marvel Universe. Him, along with Ditko and Jack Kirby, John Romita, John Buscema, whoever else was there, Gil Kane, all these great people, they, you know, they all brought it to us. I mean, obviously Stan couldn't do it all by himself. He couldn't draw the book.
No, and let's be honest. Once he stopped working with those initial creators, and you look at stuff that Stan, you know, because he would occasionally he'd create stuff in the 80s and 90s and most of it's junk. It's not good.
Yeah, he clearly had clearly lost his mojo or his he was he had moved past what you know
Yeah, and again, I think that is a sign that these books were not the result of one person, right? That the contributions of Jack and Ditko and you know other Buscema, Romita, all the people that followed them were critical in the success of those books. But I will also say, you know, you look at I think Jack's work, though very creative, did suffer when he stopped working with Stan, or at
No,
least an
and
external writer. Ditko, absolutely the same. I don't think, you know, I think it was the gelling or the,
the
you know,
combination.
the internal conflict sometimes between these guys that made the magic. That when it was just one of them, whether it's Stan or Jack or Ditko or any of these guys, when they're just working all on their own, the sum was greater than the individual parts.
Stan could come up with a plot synopsis for, say, a Fantastic Four issue. He'd give it to Jack Kirby. Well, Jack Kirby would take that and be inspired by that and embellish it and break it down into panels and then send it back to Stan with notes in the, you know, margins. And Stan
Right.
would be like, okay, how do I write this? They were challenging each other. They were pushing each other. And like you said, especially like with Jack Kirby, you know, when he goes over to DC and does the Fourth World, which I want to talk about at some point,
Yes.
he's just. He's writing it. He's the editor. He's the cook. And he's the bottle washer. And to a degree, it suffers because he doesn't have that other voice, that other creative voice saying, no, 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 let's do it this way.
Right. Or reining in a little bit or
Yeah.
clarifying or,
You got too many
yeah.
ideas for this. You can't cram everything into one issue.
Right. And you I think most creative types, you need somebody to rein in your worst instincts, because I
They're
don't
good
think
editors,
that's
yeah.
an insult. I think it's true in music.
Oh yeah, you need
You
a
know,
producer. Like you need a producer. Like
you need a
they go in.
producer, right? You need a band that's going to push back on you a little
You
bit.
need someone like a Bob Ezrin to say to Kiss, "No, this isn't good. No, you should do this."
Right. Do it again.
Yeah, do it
Go
again.
back and do it again. You could use a stronger chorus in this, whatever.
You know, Stan Lee, had people like Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko and others to bounce off of. Ultimately, he had the final say because he was the editor and he was the publisher.
Yeah.
But Stan Lee, I mean, when he passed on, I certainly felt it. I certainly felt
Oh
like
my God, it
it was
was,
an incredible loss. This guy who wrote so many of these great characters and created like these mythologies that here it is, we're 2023, Brad, and we're still talking about it to this day.
You and I are sitting here right now talking about things that we read 50 years ago. I mean, what more do you need to, and is a big part of it nostalgia? Sure. But the fact is that, well, I'll speak for myself here, but that what I read in those comics shaped me as a person, because it
Sure.
shaped me as a kid
Yeah,
and
I know, I agree.
installed morals and
Yeah.
philosophy and ideas. I grew up in a tiny New England town that was 99% white. And there were shows like The Jeffersons or whatever on TV, and of course there was news and stuff, but my real first exposure to Black people, African Americans, Black Americans, was in comics. And in reading things like Stan's Soapbox, when he would talk about,
Right,
how
yeah.
race and just the general hating. I mean, some of that was the first exposure I had to that stuff, because I lived a privileged, isolated life
Yeah.
of a small town white kid. Not wealthy,
Right.
but white privilege, it's a thing. It
Yeah.
exists,
Right.
people.
And these shaped are, like I said, and I agree with you, like they do shape your morals, they make you
Yeah,
think.
the first thing about like race riots and stuff, the
Yeah.
first I ever heard of that was in comics.
And we have people like Stan Lee to thank for that and for the
Yes.
creation. And I'm sure we'll probably talk about Stan again
We how can we not?
I'm
But
sure
I just
we'll probably discuss a run of books that he did or
sure.
But I think we got off to a good start talking about him, and I think that says it all, really.
Yeah, and for folks out there listening to this, first, thank you for listening to us
Yes.
ramble on for an hour.
Yes.
If you haven't seen the Stan documentary, I highly recommend it.
Yes.
It's worth watching, whether you're a hardcore fan or whether you're just dipping your toe into comics. It's a great introduction. And even if you are a hardcore fan, I think you'll see things you haven't seen before. You'll hear things you haven't heard before in the documentary. It's worth watching.
Absolutely. And if you enjoyed this first episode of we'll have a name for it next time, I swear. Please write a review, put down on the page, what would you like to hear us talk about? Throw some
Yeah,
suggestions our way. I mean, I
absolutely.
can tell you that the focus will probably be 60s, 70s, and 80s comic books for the most part.
Yes.
The stuff we grew up with, Marvel, DC. We're not obviously blind to the other ones, but I think primarily we're going to be talking Marvel and DC.
I think those were the most fun books
Yes.
because they were wild and wacky and goofy at times
Universe
and just
bending.
great to talk about.
Absolutely. And we'll be doing this again next month on our second episode. But until then, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks, everyone.
Mr. K Super Show. If you love the music of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, join me every month when I and a guest co-host discuss music and music-related pop culture. No stone goes unturned, no bit of trivia is too trivial as we discuss the great music of Generation X, hosted by Chris Carr. Mr. K Super Show can be found on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are hosted. Check it out. You may not regret it.
Hey, this is Brad Page from the I'm in Love with That Song podcast, inviting you to join me as we explore a different song each episode, discovering what makes these songs great. The performances, arrangements, and the production tricks and techniques are all part of creating those magic moments that turn a good song into a great one. On this podcast, we take a deep dive into each song, listening to all those nuances that came together to make it a great song. Our journey takes us across the musical map, from the Beatles and the Stones to Aretha Franklin and Tom Petty, from Aerosmith to the Zombies. We listen to it all on the I'm in Love with That Song podcast.
Thank you for listening to Back Issue Banter. If you like what you heard, please post a review on Apple Podcasts and please share on social media. On behalf of Brad Page and myself, Chris Karam, thanks once again for listening to Back Issue Banter.